Before I start, I see the best man for my wedding in the back. I won't mention his name because I'm not going to embarrass him. If you want to come sit, stand in the back, I'm going to sit up here, I'll take it. That would be great. Thank you, Dean Rutherford, Skip, for inviting me to speak here today. This opportunity is a great honor. I appreciate your kindness, hospitality, and particularly your abundant sense of fairness. I would also like to say thank you to my parents, and my mother and my mother-in-law are here, and especially my wonderful wife, Elizabeth, seated here beside my mother. Marrying her was the best decision of my life, was the most optimistic of hers. Thank you, Elizabeth, for putting up with the highs and lows of public service, and mostly for putting up with me. At first glance, one might think that Tim Griffin, speaking at the Clinton School of Public Service, is the definition of contrast. However, like many folks in the South, before I was Republican, I was a Democrat. I spent what I consider my formative years in Magnolia, Arkansas, about 30 miles southeast of a place called Hope. Hope was not only what I was taught to believe in, Hope was the place where during many summers, my friends and I would make a trip to the Watermelon Festival, and I was a big deal for a young kid from Magnolia. I got involved in politics, Democratic politics, relatively early in life. I was naturally a Democrat. My cousin was the legendary governor and Ward hero, Sid McMack. Good to see you here today. Of course I was a Democrat, but maybe more significantly, I was a conservative. I believed in faith, family, and country. I believed in limited government and unlimited God-given freedom. In the early 1980s, through my father, a Southern Baptist minister, I met an up-and-coming state senator from Camden named Bill Friendly Henley, Susan McDougal's brother. I was fortunate to be allowed to intern for Senator Henley both in 1983 and 1985 in the state legislature. The highlight of those trips to the state capitol was the obligatory picture with then-Governor Bill Clinton. In 1986, Senator Henley sought re-election to the state senate. His district's main population centers were his hometown of Camden, my wife's hometown, didn't know you then, didn't know I was running around, and my hometown of Magnolia. He was challenged by highly respected Magnolia lawyer and businessman Mike Cannon. I, of course, worked for Senator Henley, the man I knew. Kind of won in a landslide, and I learned early what it meant to be emotionally invested in a campaign and lose. It was a tough lesson to learn. I backed the out-of-town guy, and my hometown guy won. Looking back, that was the first political mistake of my life. After the campaign, Senator Henley was not so friendly. And to this day, Senator Conner is a friend and someone I respect. I'm happy to say that long after his retirement from the state senate, Senator Conner is currently serving as an advisor to Governor Mike Beattie. I entered Hendricks College in Conway in the fall of 1986, a Democrat, and remained so until I attended my first college Democrat meeting. I quickly learned there was a big difference between a conservative South Arkansas Democrat and a Hendricks College Democrat. I love Hendricks. I just want to say that for the record. I love Hendricks. I support Hendricks. It's a great school. But there weren't many folks like me, conservatives, in that club of the college Democrats. I support Hendricks for that matter. So I found a home with the college Republicans. I'll say as an aside, for a while there in the early 80s, when I was interviewing with companies, on my resume I had both college Democrats and college Republicans. It was a time of transition in my life, and it also was a conversation piece when I was interviewing with folks. They would say, well, what's this? And I would say, well, let me tell you the story. Soon thereafter, I took it off the resume. It was more confusing. My honesty was actually confusing people. During my junior year in Hendricks, I attended the Hendricks and Oxford program. at Oxford, England. Inspired in part because of the experience and education of another Arkansas student, Bill Clinton. I wanted to experience Oxford too. I fell in love with the place. It exposed me to so many new and valuable experiences and changed my life, though not my accent, permanently. Some said I had an inflection when I came back. Just happened, but some thought it would be a snob, but in any event, it's gone now. The Hendricks program allowed students, and to this day, allows students to live and study in the shadows of the Oxford colleges. It was an incredible introduction to Oxford, and during my senior year at Hendricks, I was dead set, as Rob will tell you, front row here, I was dead set on getting back to Oxford. I had to find a way, because I wanted to attend Oxford University for real. Nothing against the program, but I just wanted to go back and matriculate and really be part of the university. So during my senior year at Hendricks, I applied for the Rhodes Scholarship, which was my shot, long shot, real long shot, at returning to Oxford. As part of the application process, well, my blood pressure went up, but got on medication for that. I was interviewed in the spring of 1990 by a number of Rhodes Scholars at the Terry House, Greek Revival Mansion in downtown Little Rock. I'm pretty sure that's the name of it. To my knowledge, all the interviewers were Rhodes Scholars, except one. Her name is Hillary Clinton. She was well educated, but she wasn't a Rhodes Scholar. I assume she was sitting in for her husband. I think he was just unable to make it that day. During the interview, Ms. Clinton asked me about a paper that I had either brought up or maybe she knew from my application that I had recently written at Hendricks regarding Margaret Thatcher, one of my heroes. I didn't win the Rhodes Scholarship, didn't even come close, but I was still able to study European history at Oxford for a year, grad school before attending law school. I found a way to get there. I'll spare you the details. So for those of you who have only read about me over the past 6 months, this juxtaposition of me at the Clinton School may seem a bit odd. But for this former Democrat, it just completes the turn of the wheel. My name has been in the news quite frequently this year, particularly in the context of the U.S. Attorney Byron Hines. As with any public figure, some of what has been written about me has been true. Some has been false. Most of what Skip said is false. And much has been written with little or no context. The biggest problem, I think, is no context. Many of the allegations start with one blog entry or one article and spread like a virus. As the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Arkansas, I was legally and ethically able to defend myself publicly against various allegations. And when appropriate, I did. But it was rarely appropriate. I did not, and I do not think it is appropriate for a sitting U.S. attorney to engage in a political debate with political opponents. But I also recognize that truth is often irrelevant to those who would do you harm. So I'm here to simply tell my story. By speaking today, I hope to provide a fuller, more accurate picture of some recent events and who I am. Further, I hope my words today effectively convey the debt of gratitude that I owe so many different people who have shown immeasurable kindness to me and have given me the opportunity to serve. One of the questions that has been raised most frequently about me is, why did I come home to Arkansas? I thought we wanted to promote Arkansas. Arkansas is a great place. I don't think we're out of question why people want to come here, but that's an aside. One TV commentator wondered whether I was sent to Arkansas to investigate Hillary Clinton. I wasn't. Some have suggested, I'm not even sure how one would go about doing that, but in any event, some have suggested that I was sent to Arkansas to run for Senate in 2008. That's false. One senator opined that I was appointed so I would be in place to, quote, influence the outcome of the 2008 election, end quote. That's false. I'm not even sure I would have stayed for the 2008 election. If you've seen my resume, you'll know I don't stay anywhere more than a year.
5.5 miles. Most think that Karl Rove did the sending. That is false. In fact, I wasn't sent here by anyone. My life is full of unsuccessful attempts to move home to Arkansas and stay here, usually lured away by inescapable career and financial opportunity. Career and financial opportunity that I thank the Lord for. Before finally settling in Little Rock in 2006, for over a decade, I had sought to fulfill my abiding desire to live and work in Arkansas. If I were to write a book, it would have to be titled, "You Can Go Home Again. It Just Isn't Easy." The desire to settle in Arkansas only increased when I married Elizabeth, a native of Camden, who enjoys spending time in hot springs on the lake. No offense to the people in Washington, but I was knowingly marrying a southerner who wasn't real big on hours of commutes to work and folks honking their horns when you fail to lead a traffic light like a drag racer. We didn't need anyone to send us home to Arkansas. That's where we were headed. In fact, even if I hadn't wanted to come home to Arkansas, that's where we were headed. In 1996, I was living in Washington and serving as an associate independent counsel investigating then-House Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros for lying to the FBI. I had never lived in Washington except for a brief internship for Democratic Senator Dale Bumpers in 1992. More Democratic history. So the independent counsel position was a great job that gave me my first prosecutorial experience. After about a year, my Potomac fever had subsided, and I longed to return to Arkansas. I had corresponded with Lieutenant Governor Huckabee, and since his elevation to the governor's office, had given returning serious thought. In fact, I remember meeting him on the square in Magnolia at the Magnolia Blossom Festival in the early 90s, introducing myself, and shortly thereafter, I started writing. In the fall of 1996, I was offered a counsel position at the Arkansas Department of Education. My return to Arkansas seemed to be coming together until someone at the department leaked that an Alexandria, Virginia attorney with the Office of Independent Counsel was being considered to come back and join the state government. Sounds pretty scary. Front page of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette bore the headline, "Lawyer with firm setting Cisneros applies for state job." The article didn't mention any of my Arkansas roots. And although I didn't work for Ken Starr, it was a time when the term independent counsel did not carry the most endearing connotation in Arkansas. About the same time, I received a job in Washington, tendering more responsibility as senior counsel on the Government Reform Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. I could not turn it down, indefinitely delaying my return to Arkansas. In 1998, a little over a year later, I still wanted to move home. I had explored prosecuting in Saline County, as well as Garland County, so when a friend of mine recommended I speak with Betty Dickey, then the prosecuting attorney for Jefferson and Lincoln counties about a job, I was interested. She offered me a job, and I accepted it. A few weeks later, I drove to U-Haul in the Pine Bluff, Arkansas, sight unseen. Moved into an apartment and began prosecuting. Pine Bluff was quite a change from Washington, but I was home and within a short drive of Little Rock. 2 weeks later, Betty asked me to run her embryonic campaign for Attorney General. The financial consequences were not good, but I said yes anyway. And by the way, at that time, a lot of people said that I was sent down here to run her campaign, and I was just put at the prosecutor's office temporarily. That's also false. 3 months later, in June 1998, with a head full of lessons learned, this is 4 months later, I headed back to the Government Committee in Washington, but my heart remained in Arkansas.
The next year, I explored an attorney position at the Arkansas Public Service Commission. Seeing a pattern here? It wasn't a good fit. During law school, I clerked with the Little Rock Law Firm at Friday Eldridge Clark and enjoyed my experience there. I had passed the Arkansas Bar in 1995, so in 1998, I explored and even interviewed with a couple of the big law firms in Little Rock to no avail. It was very clear to me that the Democratic leadership of the firm, while polite and gracious, didn't see me as a fit, and I totally understood. After all, I didn't just have an R by my name, I had an R emblazoned on my forehead. So I moved on. As the 2000 presidential campaigns began to get underway in 1999, I looked for an opportunity to join one. For both philosophical and practical reasons, I set my sights on the campaign of Governor George W. Bush. I had met and made the acquaintance of former RNC chairman, Republican National Committee chairman, Haley Barbour, now the governor of Mississippi. I met with him at his office on Pennsylvania Avenue in D.C. and asked for help in getting on the Bush campaign. I wanted to join the legal office. Why? Because I was a lawyer. I reasoned and argued that I'd learned a lot about campaign finance law during my time on Capitol Hill and would be a good fit. I received a nice letter, phone call or two, thanking me for my interest, but it ended there. I kept looking. Later that year, in August, my boss at the House Government Reform Committee was offered the position of Research Director for the Republican National Committee for the presidential campaign. She asked me to be her deputy. I wasn't quite sure what political research entailed. I had an idea, but I accepted anyway. I would have taken just about any job that put me in the middle of the 2000 presidential campaign, but this had the benefit of being my only option. It was a wonderful learning experience for me, for a 31-year-old from Magnolia, to participate in the highest level of the presidential campaign. But it meant that Arkansas would have to wait again. By early 2001, Florida was over, President Bush was in office, and I was still determined to go home. People in D.C. at this point are tired of hearing about me trying to go home. There was this abiding sense that they hired me. They weren't quite sure how long I would stay because I was trying to go back to Arkansas. But in any event, Arkansas has two federal judicial districts, Eastern and Western. And if you take Arkansas and sort of put a bell curve on its side, it's a weird shape. The Eastern covers Jonesboro, Little Rock, Pine Bluff, down to Chico County, and the rest, the Western District. I'd grown up in the Western District. Magnolia's in the Western District. Elder Ray was in the Western District. So I expressed an interest in being a U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Arkansas to a number of people in the administration, transition team. Now, this is 2000-2001. And at this point, probably seen Carl Rove twice in my life, but I was trying to be U.S. Attorney. Senator Tim Hutchinson was to submit a list to the White House. I wanted to be on that list, so I had my obligatory meeting with the senator, asked a number of prominent Arkansans to write on my behalf, some Democrats. They did, at least one did. In the end, Senator Hutchinson decided on someone else. So I wasn't going home that way. So still committed to returning to Arkansas, I met with former Representative John Paul Hammerschmidt, then Republican Party Chairman, at his office in Harrison regarding the open position of Executive Director and Chief Counsel. About the same time, however, opportunity knocked, the Justice Department. The position opened up in the Criminal Division of the Justice Department, working with Assistant Attorney General Mike Chertoff. It was an enormous opportunity to serve, so I decided to remain in Washington and accepted that position. After arriving at Justice, I learned that policy lawyers were routinely granted six-month or year details, as they're called, are pretty common. You get these details to the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Eastern District of Virginia, Alexandria, or the District of Columbia. I didn't want to work in either one of those. These details allowed policy lawyers to get prosecutorial experience, an obvious benefit for lawyers at the Department of Justice, especially those in the criminal division without prosecutorial experience. It's pretty common. You got a lot of policy lawyers straight out of law school, or even those who have been out of law school a long time, who just don't have a lot of or any prosecutorial experience. It's a pretty common program. Well, I saw an opportunity to get home immediately. So in the summer of 01, I asked, could I have a detail? Sure. Can I have it to Arkansas? And I said, I'll pledge not to take the per diem. Just, I'll buy a house there. Just pay me the same thing you paid up here. I'll go down there. And I was granted that. And I was very happy. I was granted a year detail to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Arkansas, here in Louisville. I wanted to prosecute, and I wanted to do so here. So once again, with a 1,000-mile-long smile on my face, I was able to return home, driving 17 hours, these are made quicker than that, but to Arkansas. I bought a house, which I still own today, in the Heights section of Little Rock, a historic and close-knit neighborhood where small bungalows like mine share streets with mansions out of my price range. I arrived at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the fall of 2001. Longtime and highly respected prosecutor Michael Johnson was the acting United States Attorney. He had been U.S. Attorney Paula Casey's first assistant and had been elevated on her departure. The President's nomination of Bud Cummins was pending in the United States Senate at the time. During that 01-02 period, I prosecuted gun and drug cases primarily. After Bud was confirmed, he asked me to serve as the Project Safe Neighborhoods Coordinator, in addition to my prosecutorial duties. PSN, as it's called, is an initiative that fights gun-related violence by close cooperation between federal, state, and local law enforcement. In short, PSN asked state prosecutors to send the U.S. Attorney's Office, voluntarily, gun-related cases so they can be prosecuted federally. They do that because in some instances, in the federal system, the defendant can get more time and without parole. Pine Bluff was chosen as the first PSN city in the Eastern District. It was a natural fit because I would be working closely with the Pine Bluff Prosecutor's Office, and I had known and respected Steve Dalrymple, the prosecuting attorney for Jefferson and Lincoln counties, since 1998. And I knew the partnership between his office and the U.S. Attorney's Office could be a fruitful one. It was and continues to be to this day. Obviously, Bud made the decision to make Jefferson County the first place, but I was very happy about that. Still, we're very strongly about Steve Dalrymple. He's just a great prosecutor down there. In the spring of 2002, I was loving life. I look back on those days with very fond memories. I had my own home for the first time after throwing away years of rent as a law student at Tulane in New Orleans and later as a young lawyer in Washington. I wish I had all that money back. Finally, I learned what a tax deduction is. My mother, brother, and many cousins were close by, as were my friends from Magnolia, Hendricks, and some even from Tulane. Then the phone rang. I've got to learn not to answer the phone. I learned that pretty well in this thing, though. It was the Republican National Committee calling in April 2002, asking me to return to D.C. to help the President and his team prepare for the 2004 re-election campaign. It would be America's first presidential election after the trauma and uncertainty of 9/11. And I was here on 9/11. I was anxious to be a part of it and was on my way back to D.C. again. This time, I didn't have to move. I just left my stuff in my house. I was mobile. In November 2002, while I was working for the Republican National Committee, I was in Louisiana and I received a call on my cell phone. It was Governor Huckabee. Another opportunity to come home. He wanted to discuss the soon-to-be-vacant chief counsel position. Perhaps, I asked myself, is that the highest and best use of my skills and experience?
The wheels began turning in my head and on my car. Within a day or so, I drove from Baton Rouge to Little Rock. Got pulled over on the way up, I remember that, to meet with the governor. Ultimately, I decided to remain in Washington, excited about my opportunity to serve the president and build my team from scratch. I knew how demanding the 2000 presidential campaign had been, physically and mentally. But I thought that I had at least one more in me. I must note that at this time, I was single and unattached. That made moving around in what now seems like a willy-nilly fashion feasible. But God was about to shake my world up with a girl from Camden. One day in August of 2003, Shannon Bozeman, a fellow RNC employee and daughter of Arkansas Republican Congressman John Bozeman, she and I were discussing a sorority sister of hers from the University of Arkansas. Shannon wanted to set me up with Elizabeth Crane, a Camden native, who was living in Hot Springs. Elizabeth was scheduled to visit soon. I was intrigued by Elizabeth's South Arkansas roots. Shannon wondered if I was interested in meeting her. I didn't hesitate. Absolutely. Shortly thereafter, Elizabeth and a sounder, I wanted to say cattle, but I am told the correct word for a group of Razorbacks is sounder. Shortly thereafter, Elizabeth and a sounder of Razorbacks gathered in D.C., and I was fortunate enough to be included. 8 months later, I was engaged and in the middle of a campaign relationship with me in Washington and Elizabeth in Hot Springs. She didn't know what a campaign relationship was. She wasn't really into politics. Still not after the last 6 months. Not too big on either at this point. Apparently, my Marvin Gaye karaoke performance the night we met didn't deter her. I won't tell you what song it's on. In early 2004, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Arkansas, Tom Jean, resigned and took a top job, legal job at Walmart. I had won a U.S. Attorney position in the Western District, if you'll remember, in 2000-2001, but Senator Hutchinson had chosen Tom. I was interested again. Imagine that. The problem was I was serving in a relatively senior position in the middle of a presidential campaign. But I still wanted to go home. In fact, that probably made me want to go home more. My new girlfriend, soon to be fiancée, was living in Hot Springs and certainly excited about the possibility of me returning home. I began the process with Senate confirmation as the goal. Congressman Bozeman submitted my name, along with a couple of others, to the White House as his team. That's the way the process works. I interviewed with the Justice Department, and it went well. It was a tough choice. I could leave the RNC and push for the position, gamble, basically, or I could withdraw my name and continue the campaign. If we were to lose, however, I knew I would never forgive myself for leaving the RNC, particularly at this moment of decision for our country. I discussed it with friends on the Bush-Cheney campaign and at the White House. I withdrew my name, and home would have to wait again. Finally, the campaign ended in November 2004, and I began preparing for something really important. April 2nd, 2005, our wedding day. I think it's fair to say it's customary and expected, at least in the political world, folks who work hard to get a president elected to desire a position in the administration. After 2000, I had worked at Justice. After the 2004 election, I had been in Washington over 8 years. I never bought a house because I thought it was going to be a year, and then it turned into two, and then it turned into three, and all the attempts to move back home. That's why I never really understood the need to buy a house. Time flew by, literally. So I've been in Washington for over 8 years. I've worked on two presidential campaigns. I'd served as a lawyer on Capitol Hill. I'd served as an appointee at the Justice Department. Much to my disappointment, the one place I hadn't worked or I belonged to was the White House. That's what I wanted to do. There is no greater honor in the business that I'm in particular. But I also had a backup plan that involved Arkansas. One that would keep me in Arkansas. I spoke with new U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Arkansas, Bob Bowe. Talked to him about working as an assistant U.S. Attorney, a prosecutor, with a focus on South Arkansas. His office is in Fort Smith, so it's a long way logistically to El Dorado, Texarkana, and that southern part of the Western District. There are FBI agents down there, but there are not full-time prosecutors there. Every one of them lives in Fort Smith or Fox. So it's quite a difficult deal for them to really be there in El Dorado and Texarkana on an ongoing basis. I had the solution. I love that part of the state. I grew up there. So I proposed to him, I said, look, bring me on as an assistant United States attorney and let me focus on South Arkansas. I'll live in South Arkansas. I'll pay a new level of attention to the southern part of the Western District. My fiance is home of Hot Springs and our hometowns of Magnolia and Camden. Both all fall within the southern part of the Western District. And my best man's hometown of El Dorado at the time was there, and I thought, I remember talking to him about moving to El Dorado. We were excited about the opportunity of spending time there. We decided if the White House option didn't pan out, we would pursue the South Arkansas option. We didn't know I was a Karl Rove protege, so we weren't betting on the White House option. I would have used that. I told a number of folks back at the campaign in the White House that I wanted to work at the White House. I wanted to serve as associate White House counsel. It's a legal job. I'm a lawyer. I don't always get them, but I try. That would allow me to get back to the law. There are a number of these associate White House counsel slots. There are probably 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm not even sure an opening existed, but I wanted to at least explore the possibility. Just like when I took the research job in 1999 at the RNC, because it had the tremendous advantage of being the only one offered to me, I was open to doing just about anything at the White House, as long as it was at a level commensurate with my experience. For whatever reason, my first choice, the associate White House counsel position, didn't work out. Didn't have enough political juice. It probably had something to do with the fact that I wasn't on the law review at Harvard, and I didn't clerk for a Supreme Court justice. Seemed to be a lot of those in that office. My next question was, what else is available? The deputy political director job. Technically, special assistant to the president and deputy director, Office of Political Affairs. That job was sufficiently senior, I thought. But what did it do? I didn't know precisely, but I was willing to learn. I was offered the position, and I accepted. I am forever grateful for that. It was an unusual move. At least from the inside world, it was unusual. Maybe not from the outside. And the reason it was unusual is because I had very little formal political experience. And you may be thinking, oh, you're very good. Well, political in the technical sense. Party committees and campaigns are divided into a lot of different areas: communication, finance, legal, political is one of them. Now, it always struck me as strange, as it probably strikes many of you as strange. Isn't everything in a campaign political? Well, apparently not. In any event, political folks generally work on mobilization of voters, grassroots support, ground game. I was not a political guy in the formal sense, but it was the White House, so I was excited about the opportunity. Elizabeth and I were married on April 2nd, 2005 in Hot Springs. We went on our honeymoon, and in mid-April, I was leaving Arkansas once again. The most difficult, I was leaving my new bride. She had a job in Arkansas, and we couldn't really afford for her to leave until she secured one in D.C. She eventually did and moved to D.C. at the end of May. But for 2 months, I was living with the same roommate in the same place I had when I was single, without my new bride. I like my friend and roommate, a fellow in Camden, but I miss my wife. It was a nightmare. It's a nightmare for her as well. So. And oh yes, the price of public service included a sharp pay cut and long hours. Something every bride wants to hear. I can sum up my case to Elizabeth like this. Dearest bride, I want to accept a job at the White House that will pay far less than I have made in years, will require us to cut our honeymoon short, will require us to move to D.C. immediately after our wedding, will require you to quit the job in Arkansas that you love and find a job in D.C. And oh yes, I have to commit to be there for the November 2006 election. Because that's the way these jobs work. You can't leave in the middle of an election cycle. So when I took the job, when I started the job in April of 2005, the understanding, the verbal understanding, was that I would be there through the 2006 election. How does that sound, Elizabeth? All I can say is I'm still married to the world's most understanding, patient, and supportive woman. Recent press accounts have labeled me Carl Rove's protege. I wish someone would have told me that.
One would think that I spent years at the White House, but it was only 5.5 months. Probably not very bad. It was everything I thought it would be. Hectic, exciting, awe-inspiring, and an honor. I loved it. During my tenure, I saw the best and the worst of times. I worked to organize support around the country for the nomination of now Chief Justice John Roberts. That was not a hard thing to do. I was also there during the training. That was the worst of times. I attended Tulane Law School, took the Napoleonic Code based Louisiana bar before I took the Arkansas law, and practiced law in New Orleans before moving to Washington in 1995. So I know a little about New Orleans. And its topography. Like many observers who were watching the tragedy unfold on television, I thought that New Orleans would avoid it to the storm's eye, and New Orleans would be okay. I was wrong. The levee soon broke. I will never forget standing in line about to board a Southwest flight to Little Rock for Labor Day of my life. As we were about to board, I received a call from a White House colleague who told me that things were bad and getting worse, and I needed to return to the White House ASAP. I was reluctant as I looked at my wife, who detected that something on the other end of the phone just wasn't right. I hung up and told Elizabeth I had to skip Labor Day with the families. She had to go alone. I had to go back to work. She boarded the plane in tears. I returned to the White House and got to work doing whatever I could to help friends such as Donald Brazil, his father was stranded in New Orleans, and Peter Wanick, a New Orleans resident, my law school roommate, his friend was stranded in Cherry Hospital. There was one exception to my pledge that I would commit to the White House through the 2006 election, military service. I'm currently serving as a major in the Judge Advocate General Corps for the U.S. Army Reserve. In fact, tomorrow makes it 11 years. In all of my years in the Army, I have only been mobilized once, in the summer of 2005. I'll just say that some have questioned why I was only in Iraq for a matter of months. So I want to tell a little bit about my military experience. Because my order for to active duty was for a year. But they were for a year for Campbell, Kentucky. The Iraq thing was my bonus. I gave it myself. In August 2005, within days of me submitting a transfer to a new unit, the stop loss, basically a freeze, was placed on my unit. I was with the 10th LSO, a legal support organization. I'd been there for years. Okay, so 8 years. I wanted to do something new. That's what JAGs do, it's what Army guys are supposed to do, to move around to different units to get different experiences. I was trying to move to the MIRC, the Military Intelligence Readiness Command. I'd already attended the Military Intelligence Law Course at the JAG School in Charlotte. That's what I wanted to do next. I was slow in getting my paperwork to the unit because I didn't think there was a rush. That week or so that I delayed froze me in the 10th LSO, which is a great unit, by the way. Freeze was put on the stopping and transfers. The word had been put out to the soldiers of the 10th that approximately 20 officers and enlisted soldiers would be needed to serve a 365-day, one-year tour at Fort Campbell. My orders were for 1 year in Fort Campbell, the home of the 101st Airborne Division, Air Assault. Our commander saw volunteers for the year mission. On an August evening, I know you remember this, Elizabeth. Elizabeth and I were at our Northern Virginia apartment. My commander called, and he asked me whether I was interested in volunteering on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being no desire to go to Fort Campbell. How did I feel? Wrong question. I was recently married. My wife had just quit her job in Arkansas, got a new one in D.C. I had just started a job at the White House. As I faced our apartment with my phone in hand, I looked at Elizabeth and told my commander my answer was 0. I'd never been to Fort Campbell. It's a great place. But I had just been moving around way too much to volunteer for something like that to stay married. So I added, of course, if I'm called, I would gladly go. He didn't need to hear that. He knew. He knew I would gladly go, or that I would go. But I said that would be polite. Perhaps I should not have been so enthusiastic. My commander and senior leaders of the 10th LSO put together a list of soldiers to be mobilized. Apparently, one of them volunteers. So, because of my plus 4 experience, I was told later, I was one. So it was time for another pitch to Elizabeth in the name of public service. Dearest Bride, I am being mobilized to Fort Campbell, Kentucky for 1 year. I will be there the entire time, and there are absolutely no plans to send me to Iraq or anywhere else. The good news is the Army pays more than the White House. You add in all those flowers. The bad news is we will have to move once again. This time to Carson, where we have no friends, no ties, no known. This will require me to take a year of military leave from the White House and you to quit the job you're starting to get back. How does that sound? Again, all I can say is I'm still married to the most understanding and patient and supportive woman I know. Thank you again. The best part of the whole military mobilization was that Clarksville was only a 5 or so hour drive from Little Rock. That made all the difference because we were able to visit the Little Rock routine. I still have my house here. I bought it in 2001. So in September 2005, I notified my colleagues at the White House that I would be leaving for military duty. At the end of September, everyone at the White House showed great understanding and appreciation for my service. It was made very clear to me that although my deputy political director position would be filled, it was after all an election year. A White House job, same level of special assistant to the president, would be waiting on me upon my return. That's the law. Not sure the law applies to the office of president, but everyone that abides by the spirit of the law. I attended my last meeting in the Oval Office with a number of White House staffers and the president and vice president a week or so before leaving. At the end of the meeting, when the President's briefing was coming to an end, just as we were about to leave, a fellow staff member spoke up and said, "Mr. President, this is Tim's last meeting." The President asked me where I was going. It was the plot. I replied I was being deployed with the Army to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He asked for details, and I obliged. He was visibly moved and thanked me for my service. I would see him on my last day for a picture with Elizabeth in the Oval Office. He addressed me as Colonel. I had never been given a nickname from a president who was famous for nicknames. So I decided that would be mine. At a minimum, although I don't use it at the reserves. Although I think about a field promotion. At a minimum, it's a promotion. I arrived at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, the last week of September 2005, driving the U-Haul truck, followed by Elizabeth. Fort Campbell was the home of the famous Screaming Eagles, a Band of Brothers fan. Most of Fort Campbell is in Tennessee, but the post office is in Kentucky, hence Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Elizabeth and I moved into our government-funded off-post apartment and began a new, albeit temporary, life. I was accustomed to early mornings at the White House, but I had never been an early morning runner. That quickly changed. I was enjoying being Captain Griffin, Army prosecutor, and learning lots of stuff about life on active duty. After only a couple of weeks on the job, one morning I checked my voicemail and heard the voice of Major Greg Franks, an Arkansan, graduate of the University of Central Arkansas, a big Razorback fan. I knew he was in his office because he had a big Razorback on the back of his truck, or SUV. He was the rear detachment commander for the 1st Brigade Combat Team, referred to as Bastogne, named after James Battle, which also happened to be the mascot Bulldogs name. My favorite kind of dog. Major Franks, a fellow Southern Baptist, became one of my closest friends during my Army service. But on this day, Major Franks had called early and not to exchange pleasantries. The message went something like this. In fact, I think this is the first time I've heard that. Man, have I got a case for you. You need to get over here. We have a soldier who shot at his formation this morning. The police had it. That's not the bank political case. I hurried over from the JAG office to the Bastogne headquarters. Careful about the speed, because Fort Campbell was very conscientious about the traffic laws. Private Nicholas McKell had shot 3 rounds from a .357 pistol at his morning formation as he ran at them from behind the building. And he shot a 4th round while fellow soldiers pursued him. Private McKell attempted to murder, I'm going to start going faster, attempted to murder his platoon sergeant, among others. I had been a JAG for going on 10 years, but as a reservist, I had never tried a case at Fort Marshall. Working with my superior officer, Major Scott Lawson, I started my crash course in military justice. Shortly after arriving at Fort Campbell, I expressed to the staff judge advocate, the chief JAG, that I was interested in deploying to Iraq if the opportunity arose. He made it very clear to me that my orders were for Fort Campbell and that our mission was to backfill, substitute for, the active duty JAGs who were deployed to Iraq. He said that he would keep it in mind, though. I didn't tell him this. As the months passed, it became very clear that the McKell case would not be disposed of quickly, and it was my top priority. The case had drawn a little national interest and was of paramount importance to the command. The McKell case took months to prepare, and finally in late April 2006, Private McKell pleaded guilty to attempted murder and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. He decided to plead guilty to some of the charges, including the attempted murder, but decided to face a trial on a separate assault charge. Shortly before the trial and plea date, the staff judge advocate said he had confirmed the need downrange in Iraq for a JAG to serve with the 172nd Striker Brigade in Mosul. Strikers are the new, relatively new, kind of Army vehicle. I was ready to go, but going, I have to confess, was easier than explaining my decision to Elizabeth. I completed pre-deployment training and then flew to Kuwait, where I was in process. My first flight from Kuwait to Iraq was in a C-130 to Boston engine and had to turn around. Lucky me. I was not concerned about crashing because the plane had 3 additional engines. I dreaded an additional night in Kuwait where the heat makes Iraq seem like the North Pole. I finally made it to my new home in northern Iraq within the infamous Sunni Triangle. My first stop was Contingency Operating Base Spiker in Tikrit, the hometown of Saddam Hussein. few days later, I traveled by helicopter to Mosul, where I was slated to support the 172nd Striker Brigade Combat Team JAG Office. I met some great Americans in Mosul, one of them Captain Charles Passenger of the Cornell Emory Law Graduate. He led the JAG Office there. It wasn't easy being away from home, but I met lots of folks like Charles who remained friends with a unique experience and a common bond. Last month, Charles flew down from Alaska, and we reconvened in Magnolia for the Blossom Festival, a culture almost as foreign to him as Missoula. As a JAG, most of my time was spent at Forward Operating Base Marez. Bob Marez, where a suicide bomber blew himself up and killed 22 others in the dining hall in December 2004. You may remember that. I was reminded of that tragedy every day, every time I saw the memorial as I would make my way to chapel. But generally speaking, the fog felt safe until mortars came flying in. Occasionally, one would hear a loud explosion and sometimes would feel the ground tremble. Routinely, one would look at another soldier and say, "Was that a mortar?" A short discussion of what it might have been and where it was ensued. Occasionally, a siren would sound to chow hall and empty as folks scrambled to the bunker, then back to eating and working. One routinely hot and sunny day, I was in my compartmentalized housing unit, affectionately called a chute. I heard an incredibly loud explosion accompanied by a number of other explosions. I darted out of my chute, asked my fellow soldier, is everyone okay? He was already near a jog and had little time for me. I immediately made my way to the JAG office about 200 yards away and tried to figure out what had just happened. Captain Messenger and I made our way to the Tactical Operations Center, where we discovered that numerous mortars had hit on or around Bob Marez. I learned that the mortar that had shaken my shoe so violently had landed about 70 to 75 meters from me. My feeling of safety never completely returned. I didn't tell Elizabeth about that until I got too late, way back. On one occasion, I took a trip in a Black Hawk to a nearby operating base to provide legal assistance to soldiers. As I flew over rural Iraq in a helicopter during the middle of the day, I was able to picture all the Bible stories I knew unfolding before me. The tiny villages with the sheep and the earth-toned construction. It all looked as familiar as church on Sunday morning, even though I'd never seen it until that day. My mission was to support the 172nd Striker Brigade. Some of you may remember the Alaska-based unit that began redeploying back to Alaska and then had to return to Iraq. Most of the 172nd soldiers were still in Iraq when they found out that they were indeed leaving Mosul, but not to go home. They were going to Baghdad for a few more months. This after months of anticipation and longing for home. It was amazing to watch the reaction of the 172nd soldiers when they learned they weren't going home so soon after all. Were they disappointed? Yes. Were some angry? Yes. But I saw these brave soldiers suck it up and take their mission in stride. I don't know how they did it. I couldn't have. The 172nd Striker Brigade Combat Team left for Baghdad in early August. Soon thereafter, I was on my way back to Fort Campbell via Kuwait and Fort Bliss, Texas. My year of active duty was coming to an end. During much of my time at Fort Campbell, Elizabeth lived in our Little Rock home and eventually got her old job back, both critical steps toward our eventual permanent transition back to Arkansas. The question of what I would do after the Army remained unanswered. U.S. Attorney Bud Cummins and I had openly talked about me following in his footsteps, and he had openly discussed moving on. Public documents now demonstrate that at least one list, maybe more, of U.S. attorneys to be asked to leave was prepared before I ever began work at the White House, and Bud was on that list. Also, as indicated by other public documents, I knew that Bud would be asked to leave before he did. Regardless, I was not at liberty and in a position to disclose that to him. Elizabeth and I routinely discussed whether I would go back to the White House after my Army tour, and if the U.S. attorney position would open up during my absence. I suspected, based on my conversations with Bud, that he might leave on his own. My initial worry was that Bud would either leave of his own volition or would be asked to leave while I was on active duty, and someone else would be chosen to be U.S. attorney. In retrospect, that was apparently a worry without foundation, but I did not know that for certain when I left the White House in 2005. In fact, Bud expressed this exact concern to me in an April email after I told him I was headed to Iraq. He asked, "How long in Iraq? Where? How are you going to be the next U.S. attorney here when I get a job this summer and leave?"
So when I learned from Bud that he had been asked to leave in the summer of 2006, I wasn't surprised. Certainly, if Bud was leaving, I hoped to be his successor. As I said, we had talked about that. No doubt about it. But no one promised me the U.S. attorney position, nor could they, because the president personally decides that. I knew that I had friends in the administration who valued my service and who thought my skills and experience fit the position, no doubt about it. I knew I had friends who wanted me to have that job, no doubt about it. For that, I was and remain grateful. In fact, I would have been shocked. I would have been hurt if an individual who has a strong legal education and background, worked on both of the president's election efforts, had served with the Department of Justice, had served on the president's staff, had served in Iraq, would be denied consideration for a U.S. attorney position in his home state, just based on what I know about previous appointments, both in this administration and other administrations. But anything could happen in Washington, and as you can probably gather by now, it was all about making sure I had an option so that I would not be jobless. I did not have the liberty of being unemployed. So, anything could happen in Washington, so I kept an eye on openings at the White House throughout my military service in case I had to return there. As I mentioned, there was a slot for me, but I wanted to make sure that there was something to go to. I didn't want something to sort of create it to have a check. From the beginning of the U.S. attorney process, I intended to go through with Senate confirmation and actually began completing the paperwork for that process. In fact, I think that paperwork was emailed to me in Iraq. At some point in the late summer, I learned of the Patriot Act provision that allowed for an indefinite attorney general appointment. Ultimately, I wanted to be confirmed by the Senate, and naively, perhaps, thought I would be. But I was amenable to accepting an appointment that met the requirements of the law. As United States District Judge in Little Rock, Tom Isaac said in his opinion, upholding the legality and constitutionality of my appointment, although the present arrangement might result in de facto U.S. attorneys serving for lengthy periods without the Senate's confirmation, that possible result is the product of Congress's own making and can be changed by new legislation. He continued, whether good policy or not, question. Whether good policy or not, Section 546 of the Patriot Act clearly expresses the will of Congress that the Attorney General have the authority to make their own appointments. End quote. And Congress is now working to change that law, as is their right. U.S. Attorney Blake Cummins and I first met when I prosecuted in his office from 01-02. We got along well, we laughed a lot, we laughed a whole lot, and worked well together. Upon the end of my Army tour in September of last year, I began prosecuting for Bud again. Bud was planning his exit, but despite the circumstances, we got along well, we laughed a lot, we laughed a whole lot, and we worked well together. I am grateful to Bud for the kindness he showed me and the instruction he gave me during the transition. It hadn't been hard on him as it was hard on me. After taking office in December 2006, when insurmountable objections were made to my candidacy by my home state senators who did not share my political affiliation, I had to consider the challenge of a recess appointment that was a legal possibility, but that was not my call. In fact, the manner of my appointment was ultimately never my call. I had to take into account the infinitesimal probability that Senate hearings would focus fairly and objectively on the actual merits of my qualifications, experience, and service to my country, despite the highly polarized political environment we have today in Washington. In the end, I did not think it would serve my young family, nor the state I love so much and have tried to serve honorably to subject us to such a process. Elizabeth and I are expecting a daughter, Mary Catherine, in August. We had a family to start. It was time to begin again. So in February, before the White House sent my name to the Senate for confirmation, I withdrew my name for consideration. During my brief tenure as United States Attorney, I'm proud of what the United States Attorney's Office accomplished. We began a special push to provide outreach and training in rural counties such as Greene County in Northeast Arkansas, where we held a regional intelligence meeting.
state police trooper said to me, quote, "I've been working in law enforcement up here for 20-something years, and this is the first time I've ever seen a U.S. attorney in Greene County." It was comments like that that kept me going. I'm also very proud of the U.S. Attorney's Office's close cooperation with the FBI in providing federal civil rights law training to law enforcement and community leaders. In January, I attended an FBI-sponsored civil rights working group, and after hearing Michael Johnson, who I referred to earlier, after I heard him speak, we decided to provide federal civil rights law training around the Eastern District. Mainly each year. Help with that. We started with Pine Bluff and then Monticello. Both meetings were resounding successes. The best part of serving as U.S. Attorney, though, is the people. I enjoyed working with my friends, the dedicated public servants of the U.S. Attorney's Office, many of whom I first met during my service as Special Assistant U.S. Attorney. They welcomed me. They taught me, they inspired me, served shoulder to shoulder with me, and have been an absolute joy with which to work. I miss them dearly. I want to say a few words in closing about the press, particularly the Arkansas press. I receive fair treatment consistently from the local television news as well as KDRN Radio and Ron Breedy at KDAR. The three print reporters with which I had a significant amount of contact over my tenure as U.S. Attorney were Linda Sadler of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, she's here, Aaron Sadler of Stevens Media, and Ray Keene of the Pine Bluff Commercial. I must say that all three of these journalists demonstrated a respect for journalistic ethics and for me as a person. They asked tough questions and did their job well, and I appreciated that. So did my wife. Although I have to say that I was 34 in the first article describing my appointment, and was 38 only 1 month later. Evidence of how much this entire experience has aged me. Over the years, I've experienced the highs and lows of public service, whether in the White House, the Congress, the Army, or the U.S. Attorney's Office. Looking back on my experience, I can only say thank you. Thank you to the many people who have made my public service possible, the people who hired me. Thank you to the President for allowing me to serve at the White House and later as U.S. Attorney. Thank you to the professionals of the U.S. Attorney's Office for their welcome and their kindness. Thank you to federal, state, and local law enforcement that I had the honor of working with while at the U.S. Attorney's Office, especially fellow Hendricks graduate Bill Temple of the FBI. Bill Bryant of the Drug Enforcement Administration, and our superstars and good friends. And thank you to the Democratic prosecutors and many Democratic office holders who were so kind to me and full of encouragement. I won't mention your name, so you won't have any explaining to do. Thank you to my family, and most of all, I would like to thank the Lord. Recent events have confirmed, if you want to hear God laugh, tell him your plans. At the risk of making God laugh, Elizabeth and I have made a few plans. Two planners, Mary or Gerald. We are definitely staying in Arkansas, this time for good. We love our neighborhood and we love our friends here. Our baby will be here shortly and we want her to be in our kingdom. As far as my career is concerned, I will continue to practice law, and I'm in the process of opening a bipartisan public affairs firm here in Little Rock that will focus on strategic consulting for businesses, issue advocacy, government relations, and crisis communications. The challenges our next president faces are immense. There's never been a time in our country's history of such peril and such promise. For me and Elizabeth personally, these are exciting times. Exciting times to bring a young daughter into the world. We do it confidently and optimistically, because in this time of great uncertainty and great opportunity, we're convinced of this. The people of this great nation we love can rise to any challenge they always have. They always have and always will. I have seen it in every step of my journey, a journey that always brings me back home to the great state of Arkansas. Thank you, Arkansas. Thank you. Thank you, the most patient and understanding and supportive woman in the world. And may God bless all of us fortunate enough to make our home here.
microphone on? Testing, 1, 2. Now it's on. All right. We have time for some very quick questions. So if you will raise your hand.
I apologize.
No, it's all right. It's your form. I really appreciate you being here. Have a question right here. Please keep your questions short, if you do, please.
Thank you, Mr. for coming to speak. With regards to your so-called caging list that we've heard a lot about, what was Karl Rove's role in its creation? Did he know about it? What was his role? How did you articulate it? And also, what was the purpose of the list?
I'm actually glad you asked that. I've seen the internet, obviously. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Obviously, I've seen the internet stuff about caging. I'll first just say the allegations that are on the internet and now expressed in tabloids and what have you are completely and absolutely false, number one, and ridiculous. Caging, as you may know, I had to look it up, is a direct mail term for basically organizing return to mail. Now, I know that it has been defined newly on the internet as some sort of purging voters, suppressing voters, caging voters, vote caging, all these different things go back to one guy, his name I won't mention, who wrote something about me and when I came into control of the U.S. Attorney thing, he gets jackpot because he had somebody in the story now in the media. It's completely untrue, and I mean, it's not even, there's not even a scintilla of truth to his theory. And I'll just say that it's so untrue. I don't know exactly what you want me to say. I didn't do any of the stuff that he alleges. So, and of course, if I didn't do it, I don't know of any Karl Rove impact. I'm not saying that he says all this. This is all made up of false talk. I didn't cage boats. I didn't cage mail. I didn't cage animals. I'm not a zookeeper, but I know I'm taking a long time, but I would like to say something about this, sort of unrelated. The issue of civil rights is real important to me for a lot of different reasons. And when I was U.S. attorney, we did the training as I talked about. Something else that is public that you may or may not have seen is that while I was U.S. attorney, we indicted an individual for threatening someone with racial epithets and other threatening language. And basically we're trying to keep that individual from living in that neighborhood. I have a little experience of my own that has directly impacted me and has sort of guided me on issues like this and civil rights issues. In 1972, my father, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, was a pastor at a Southern Baptist church in Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte, 1972, was not a progressive, offensive Charlotte. It is not the city that it is today. Okay? It was a small southern, relatively small southern city. If you talk to Rex Horn and other Southern Baptist ministers, in Arkansas, you will find out that my dad is a great, incredible, loving hero of mine, but he's unorthodox at times. He allowed for young African Americans in that neighborhood to use the gymnasium at Wilmot Baptist Church in the late 60s, early 70s. I was there, but I was barely young. And he even proposed at one point to have an associate pastor that was African American. This is 1972 in Charlotte. One day he was standing outside of Wilmot Baptist Church, and a portly man in a Cadillac came up to him and said, "Hey, preacher." And my dad walked over. And he handed my dad a rolled up, bound, or whatever, paper towel. And my dad had that paper towel. And when I was growing up, I can't remember when I first heard the story, but he kept it pressed in a file folder in our house. And what it said, the Ku Klux Klan is watching you, white N-word preacher. That was a threat to my dad. It was a threat to my dad because of what he was doing in the community. So, he kept, for years he kept that in the file cabinet. And I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, I pulled it out, had it framed in acid-free matting and all that stuff. So that my daughter, now I know it's a daughter, so that my kid will know what that stands for. And that means a lot to me. And not only is the stuff that's been described on the internet wrong and completely false, I'm not going to litigate it here in this forum, but it's completely false. I would never do that. Number one, because it's wrong, and I would never do it. Number two, because it dishonors what my father did. My father has been a huge influence in my life, and so I just think there needs to be a little context there. And I'll tell you this too.
One more thing I want to say on this.
When I met with Dale Charles at the NAACP head here in Little Rock, I met with him in January right after I became U.S. Attorney because I thought that was the right thing to do. I had known him for several years. He told me, he said, this is the first time in X years, a lot of years, that he had met with the U.S. Attorney. So I think my actions speak for themselves, and stuff on the internet is garbage.
Okay, we got time for one more question. I'm sorry. Yes, sir. Right here.
It's obvious that you are very emotional about a lot of your experiences. What effect did your experiences, the public knowledge of your experiences and perceptions, whether they're right or wrong, what do you think they'll have on people who seem to be a fair like you are, wanting to do what you did in their careers and pursue the same, you know, whether they're Republicans or Democrats? What do you think your experiences affect publicly and reading about these kinds of experiences continually will have on people's desire to pursue that?
Thank you.
As a career.
Skip and I were discussing right back here before I came out to speak. I discuss this with my wife all the time. It runs people off from public service. There is no doubt about it. I'll tell you what. I'm not too interested in public service right now. It's a shame. It has been extraordinarily difficult. And I cannot imagine what it's like for people who go through years of this. If you asked me and you didn't, whether I would do this whole thing over again. That's sort of where that leads. Is it worth it? It's not worth it. It's not worth it because I'm married now. I'm about to have a kid. When I was single, willy-nilly, happy-go-lucky, I was all I had to be worried about. It may have been worth it. But to see the impact it has, we found out in November that we're pregnant. We haven't been able to enjoy that the way we should have. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I put my wife through this. I'm proud of you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause.